Oh, that's Tanya, composed by Donald Byrd and interpreted by Dexter Gordon. It's from Gordon's 1964 album, One Flight Up. Gordon is on tenor sax, Donald Byrd on trumpet, Kenny Drew on piano, Liels Henning Orsted on bass, and Art Taylor on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we are going to start first with a report from a very valued reporter. His name is Kurt Guyatt, an investigative reporter with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan, who you may recall was the first person to report the scandalous situation in Flint, Michigan, as it relates to the poisoning, really, of the whole city by officials there who never told the people the truth until he presented report after report on what he had found in Flint, Michigan, with this toxic lead-laced water that was being distributed throughout the city's broken-down water system. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for that very nice introduction.
Well, it's true. And we have depended upon and looked to you for your continuing reports on this, which you broke, I believe, in, I would say,
July of 2000.
2000?
July of 2015.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
2015. And without those reports, I think this matter might have just gone totally underground and hidden from view.
Oh, well, that's nice to say, but I really think that the people of Flint were very determined to get to the truth and, you know, would have gotten there one way or another. But because, you know, that's part of what gets missed in this narrative, especially when the big mass media get a hold of it. They overlook the role that just everyday citizens played by coming together and working together to find out first what was going on with their water and then help expose it. But
no question. And thanks for reframing it that way. Just barely a week after Flint, Michigan officials criminally were charged with involuntary manslaughter for knowingly allowing toxic water to be distributed throughout the city's water system, I am told that there's something developing that will be a massive follow-up to this the series of convictions.
Well, it's pretty interesting, especially for those who have not followed this story closely, because along with the lead contamination that occurred starting when Flint, under the control of an appointed emergency manager, switched from the Detroit system to using the Flint River in a supposedly cost-cutting measure, and because they did not have the capacity to adequately treat the water and actually were not doing certain things at all, that led to the lead contamination issue. But also, within 2 months of switching to the river, health officials in Genesee County, where Flint is located, started communicating to state health officials concerns about a dramatic spike in Legionnaires' disease. Legionnaires' disease is a waterborne illness, but you don't get it from drinking water. You get it from inhaling the mist. That's a disease that's very similar to pneumonia. And so the first alarm among health officials about this dramatic spike in Legionnaire's disease occurred right around 2 months after the switch to the river. And what happened was that just as they weren't able to properly treat the water to prevent lead from leaching into it, they also were just unable to do basic disinfection, applying the right amounts of chlorine. And so because they weren't putting the right amounts of chlorine in, the Legionnaire's bacteria was allowed to not be killed off. And then, making the situation even worse, the iron particles that were getting into the water because they weren't using proper corrosion control served as food for the Legionnaire's bacteria. So you had them not killing the bacteria and then actually feeding the bacteria. And as a result of this, at least 12 people died, and close to 100 got sick. And that's just the cases they know about, because one of the consequences of this crisis not being widely reported was the likelihood that doctors didn't know what was going on and were probably misdiagnosing a lot of pneumonia cases, thinking it's pneumonia when it was really Legionnaire's disease. I remember back in August of 2015 when we were working on our documentary about this, I was in the home of a Flint mom, had four kids that were like elementary school age or younger, and she told me all four of them got pneumonia in the summertime. And she, at that point, was asking scientists from Virginia Tech if Legionnaires was a possibility, because it's so unusual for any kid to get pneumonia in the summertime. And the researcher, Dr. Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, was looking for chlorine coming out of the water in her home when she raised this issue, and he said, I'm not finding chlorine anywhere I go. In no house I've tested yet have I found chlorine. So the charges that were brought last week against five either current or former officials were involuntary manslaughter charges. Essentially what the state attorney general is saying is that there was evidence there that there was a Legionnaires was a significant problem, and that there was a likelihood that it was due to using the river water, because the spike occurred, like I said, within 2 months of the river being used. And so those charges were brought last week. One of the people charged was the director of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. So this is the highest level official that's been charged so far, a member of the governor's cabinet. It was also disclosed that investigators requested to interview the governor, and the governor declined to be interviewed unless an investigative subpoena was issued, compelling him to testify under oath. And I've been trying since last week to find out why the Attorney General's office didn't take that necessary step and get the governor answering questions under oath, because apparently that subpoena was never obtained, and the governor hasn't answered questions from investigators yet. So that's kind of where things stand in terms of the criminal investigation at this point, which it looks like the criminal investigation is beginning to wind down to some extent, and efforts are going to be put into what the Attorney General called the prosecution phase. There's 15 people that have been charged with felonies in relation to this crisis. Two of them have cut plea deals with prosecutors in exchange for their cooperation. They pled no contest to misdemeanor charges and were given probation. But there's 13 people still about to, unless something changes, go to court and face significant felony charges, a whole variety of felony charges that have been filed in this case.
Is it the case that they're trying, they're looking into it now, or it's confined to the state level? Have they gone yet to the federal level through the Department of Justice, for example?
Well, there are two investigations going on. The current one involves the Michigan Attorney General's office and the Genesee County Prosecutor's Office. But there is also, and this was disclosed last year, the U.S. Justice Department and the Criminal Investigation Unit of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency had also launched investigations. But no charges have been brought as a result of those investigations. And honestly, don't even know if those investigations are still ongoing or whether they've been shut down. The feds are very tight-lipped, and now we have the Trump administration rather than the Obama administration. So there's no telling for certain what's going on with those federal investigations. But they, at least last year, were, you know, still pursuing those investigations, and so it's unknown what's happening on that front. But you know, we do know what's happening with the state investigation, and charges have been brought against state officials, emergency managers that were involved in the decision to use the river, and a couple of city employees have also been charged as well.
Have there been any actions filed in behalf of the individuals who have been harmed by this water crisis?
Yeah, there have been both several dozen people are pursuing their own cases where they are suing public officials. And then there's at least a few class action suits that have been filed both in state and federal court. And those lawsuits are continuing to move through the court system. Those kinds of suits are slow going, and they're difficult. And so this is an odd situation where, on the one hand, you have the Attorney General's office bringing criminal charges against the individuals that they say are responsible for this crisis. But at the same time that they're doing that, they are sort of tooth and nail every step of the way fighting the attorneys that have been brought the class action lawsuits. So it's a somewhat of a schizophrenic situation going on there in the Michigan Attorney General's office.
Well, it is said to be, Flint is the fourth largest or fifth largest city in the state of Michigan, about 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. And predominantly African-American. Is anybody looking at the contributing factors here in the way that the officials behaved, that they could so blithely switch the water supply? They knew it was toxic. They kept their mouths shut about it. People were getting very, very ill. Mm-hmm. Lead is not one of the things that, you know, you can just get rid of once it's in your body. especially right. in children developing. It takes a very deadly toll. I'm looking at the racial implications here of how this city essentially, whether they meant it from the beginning or not, I think we can't discount the possibility, the very real possibility, that the decision in part was informed by racial motives. They say, well, look, you know, okay, it's not a big deal. This is a city with many expendable people. They can cope with it until we get it fixed. If ever it becomes known, we can handle it. So I'm asking whether you know of any organizational entity, whether a research entity is mm-hmm. looking at this and drawing these kinds of parallels. There was, the city Tunica, Mississippi, which was just totally polluted, completely polluted. And they knew about it, and they just left it alone. So that is an aspect of the responsibility, the culpability, it seems to me, of the political leadership and the bureaucracy. You can't discount it as being a major factor, perhaps, in their decision-making.
Yeah, there's a lot of things along those lines. One is that the Michigan Civil Rights Commission earlier this year released a report talking about the different ways in which racism played a role in what went on in Flint. A law professor at Wayne State University by the name of Peter Hammer produced a very lengthy report that he submitted as testimony to that commission that goes even deeper in looking at the different ways in which racism was involved, both structural, historic racism that led Flint to be in the dire financial situation it was, and then more active racism. I mean, one of the things that came out was an email from someone working at the EPA who said, is Flint really the kind of city we want to go out on a limb for? Mm. And then in these recent charges that were filed against the director of the state's Department of Health and Human Services, it's alleged that at one point, his name is Nick Lyon, it's alleged that at one point when according to the Attorney General's office, people from the governor's office, as well as Nick Lyon, were putting pressure on researchers at Wayne State University who were connecting the dots between the use of the river and the Legionnaires' outbreak. And they were trying to shut down that research, alleged in these court documents. And one of the researchers explained to Lyon and an unnamed senior advisor to the governor that they needed to keep going with the research because they still didn't know for certain the source of the outbreak and more people could die. And according to the court documents, the defendant, Nick Lyon, the guy in charge of protecting the health of the people of Michigan, responded by saying, quote, they all have to die of something. So that shows the level of concern state officials were showing for the people of Flint. And it's not just a race issue. It's also a poverty issue. I'd say about 40% of Flint's population lives below the poverty line. So it's not just people of color who are living there and being disregarded. It's also poor people in general. And that's sort of the pattern for all of these cities that were taken over. In total, 8 cities were taken over by the state under this extreme emergency manager law. And with one exception, all were majority minority cities, and also with one exception, all of them had very high poverty rates. So that's what was getting taken over, not, you know, rich white cities. It was poor cities filled with mostly African Americans.
Well, this is one of the reasons I asked the question, because I would think that enough evidence exists to show that very pattern that you're talking about, that certain communities are being targeted and the consequences could be so dire, even fatal, but it is not accidental. Somebody's got to explain how it was and how it is that these communities, these cities, small towns and cities, are being targeted for this kind of governmental action. And people are not suspecting until they notice a lot of their neighbors are falling sick. People in their families are becoming sick.
Right.
And there's no effort to treat this, at least from the beginning when you started. There's no effort to see how far spreading it is, or what it could be to direct some kind of resources to finding out what is happening here. Meanwhile, we have people who you could call the future residents of the towns and cities that are affected, whose lives are shortened. And we seem to have no response from Washington, D.C. We seem to have no, either on the judicial level nor on the environmental level. And yet people are dying.
Yeah. So since late in 2015, the governor allowed, once the pressure became so great and all this a lot of this information had started coming out, the governor gave in to the demands of the people of the city, because at one point the city council voted to return to the Detroit system in March of 2015. They did that, and they were still under the control of one of these state-appointed emergency managers who said, no, you can vote all you want. It doesn't matter, because your votes don't matter. If I disagree with them, then I'm overruling them. And what I'm saying right now is, A, the you cannot afford to go back to the Detroit system, and B, besides, your water's just fine anyhow. So essentially, just shut up and keep drinking it, because you don't have any other choice. And, you know, that was the situation before we started bringing out the truth about what was going on. But the Legionnaires didn't really come out until the governor himself raised the issue in January of 16. So your readers or your listeners should just think about this for a second. They switched to the river in April of 2014. By June of 2014, 2 months later, they're seeing a concerning spike in Legionnaires' cases. That was June of 2014. It wasn't until January of 16, 18 months later, that the public was informed of what these officials knew all along, that there was a very dangerous Legionnaires' epidemic outbreak in and around Flint. It took them 18 months to warn the public about what was going on, which is why some people are facing manslaughter charges now.
What's happened to the city's move to seize people's houses if they're not paying their water bills?
There has been a moratorium put on that. There was a public outcry. The ACLU of Michigan sent a letter to the mayor, city council, city attorney, expressing our concerns about that, and as a result, the city council voted to put a moratorium. But even that decision, so there's no more emergency manager in place. The emergency manager was removed by the governor in April of 2015, saying that the financial crisis had been resolved. But that under this law, what happens when the emergency manager leaves office, something called Receivership Transition Advisory Board, which is all appointees, again, by the state, has final say over major contracts and budget decisions. And I might have missed it, but the last I had heard, this RTAB is what it's called for short, still had not agreed to go along with what the city council voted for in terms of this moratorium on foreclosures related to inability to pay water bills. So again, you know, democracy was taken away from people of Flint, and democracy, even now, after all this, still has not been fully restored.
Well, and apart from that, I want to ask a question about where does this contaminated water that is still circulating, is it 100% treated now? And if not, where is it going?
So there was two contributing factors to the crisis. One was the use of the river itself, which is the river water is much more difficult to treat than the Lake Huron water that had previously been used to provide Flint with its municipal water supply. On top of that, along with switching to the river, they also switched to the water treatment plant in Flint. Previously, it was the Detroit Regional System using cleaner, safer lake water and then being treated by the Detroit system. You know, essentially, Flint was being provided with clean, pretreated water. When they went to the river, they started treating it themselves. They didn't know what they were doing. The water treatment plant itself and the people running it didn't have the capability to properly treat the water, which led to both the Legionnaires outbreak and the lead contamination.
The reason I ask is, you know, like any water system, you have a runoff somewhere.
It goes to a wastewater treatment plant. Two major things have been done to address the crisis. One is the switch back to the Detroit system using Lake Huron water, and also stop having the Flint treatment plant treat the water, so they don't have to do that. So it is now cleaner, safer water that is going to people's homes. But there is so much damage was done to the infrastructure by this highly corrosive, improperly treated river water that it just literally was like tearing the pipes apart. It was so corrosive. So it's been proved to be very difficult to reestablish kind of the coating on those pipes that prevents things like lead from leaching into the water. But the other thing is that the system itself is so much over capacity. Flint used to be 200,000 people. Now that it's fewer than 100,000 people. And it was also, when it was 200,000 people, they had the auto industry was really thriving. Now a lot of these auto plants, Flint's the home of General Motors, a lot of these auto plants have been shut down. But the water pipes, the water mains, these huge water mains leading to them are still part of the system. And so one of the issues is that this water will sit in the system much longer than it should, causing the chlorine to dissipate and, again, creating a situation where bacteria can, again, become a problem. So it's an inherently difficult and tricky thing to do to properly disinfect the water up in Flint, even if you know what you're doing. And now there's a lot of people involved, a lot of experts, including Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, is still involved. And you know, it's a real challenge. The water still has not been deemed safe to drink unless it is run through a filter. So there's still a lot of issues the people of Flint are facing. But one of the biggest issues is that no matter who's saying the water might be safe, there a lot of people aren't believing it because they were so callously lied to and abused by their government before. Their trust has been shattered, and it's reestablishing trust is every bit as difficult, if not more difficult, than correcting the problems with the water.
And you have the ancillary problems also surfacing where homeowners, for example, they can't sell their homes.
Yes. Nobody wants to buy a home in a city with
poisoned water.
Right. Yep. And then you have the issues of we have a lawsuit right now against the state trying to compel the state to provide all the educational and wraparound services and support systems that are so badly needed to mitigate to the fullest extent possible the damage done to these lead poisoned children so that they are able to reach their full potential. Mm-hmm. And the state is fighting us on that. We tried been trying to reach a settlement with them without going to court, and so far I've been unable to do that.
It all goes back
to the same sort of thinking. The reason that the state actors were trying to cover up what was going on, both in terms of the lead and the Legionnaires, was because it was their decisions to use the river that led to these in the first place, and them admitting that they made the decision, even getting them to admit that they made the decision to use the river. They lied and lied and lied about that and tried to blame it on Detroit when it just wasn't true. But they were trying to avoid the culpability and the responsibility that is now being asked of them to step up and do everything they can to correct all the problems that they created.
Well, why don't we do this, Kurt? I'm sure people would like to ask you some questions directly. So we'll take a break, and would you be available to answer some of these questions?
If I can, sure. Happy to.
Oh, okay. 888-874-4888. Right after this, we will have a Q&A with Kurt Guyette. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Our guest is Kurt Guyette, who had broken the story about the scandal, the awful water scandal that has been around the city's neck for quite some time, much of it unknowing to the population in Flint, Michigan. Your calls at 888-874-4888. If not, we'll say goodbye to Kurt, but he's here And maybe you have some questions that we have not raised in the course of this interview, and maybe you want to know something different or something more on a question already explained. So, okay, you'll have about a couple of minutes. Kurt, what happens now in terms of how do you see things shaping up is really what I hope to have you answer.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
How do you see things shaping up in terms of the battle, the ongoing battle?
Oh man, that's first of all, I try to stay away from predictions. You know, I'm a reporter, not a predictor. But that it's all these struggles are uphill struggles. In the terms of the Attorney General's office, so they now have active criminal cases against 13 people. With a rare exception, the state is paying for the legal defense of those 13 people. So the Attorney General's office staff is, I think, in danger of being a little bit overwhelmed by taking on all these cases simultaneously with all these different legal teams that they're up against. Like I said, the state at the same time it's trying to bring those prosecutions is fighting tooth and nail against the lawyers bringing individual and class action suits. You know, so it's all very difficult, very, very difficult for the trying to bring justice one way or another for the people of Flint. It's very difficult.
Ma'at, you're on the air with Kurt Guyot. A question. Are you there? Okay, Gabriel from Connecticut, you're on the air with Kurt Guyot.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you doing, Latrice?
Fine, thank you. And our guest is Kurt.
I have two quick questions. One is, isn't it really a testament to the way the shenanigans and the way they were the administrators and the local government subdivision of the municipalities and the public officials, isn't it a testament to their tactical skills of obfuscating? More a testament to their skills to avoid prosecution, as opposed to a testament to the opposing side of those seeking recourse and relief. That's the first question. Isn't there more of a testament to them, to the officials, particularly white males, white Anglo-Saxon males of a certain economic status and positions of power? And authority, of course, who resisted that prosecutions or indictments. And the second question is,
that was the second question.
There's an International Court of Justice. Has any case or any potential litigant petitioned the International Court of Justice, bypassing the whole entire corporate structure of United States jurisdiction for recourse and remedy?
So in answer your second question first, I'm not aware of that happening. That doesn't mean that people haven't tried, but I'm not aware of that happening. In response to your first question, the fact is that 15 people have been charged with serious felonies so far. So they have not been... at least, 15 of these people have not been successful at avoiding being charged with felonies. Last week, five people were hit with involuntary manslaughter charges. That's a very serious crime. I think the maximum penalty for that is 15 years in prison. But it's also a very difficult crime to get a conviction on. So you know, maybe
who resisted
the point that you're making,
prosecutions or indictments. And the second question is,
the second question.
That's getting some crossover here. Okay, thank you, Gabriel, for your question. Matt, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Am I on now? Can you hear me?
Yes, you were on before.
Oh. Yeah, but you couldn't hear me. I could hear you, though. But anyway, thank you for this program. I would like him to...
It's Kurt Guyette.
Yes, and Kurt, I'd like you to spell your last name so we can go and read some of your investigative reports or the best way to find it. That's rather extraordinary in terms of 15 people being charged. I'd like some of your assessment in the first part of my concern as to, you know, what type of prosecution team is being brought to the fore. And also, I'd like some of your thoughts on the fact, one report that I heard is that in the five people that were charged, it seems that at least some of them are being retained by, Snyder? Is it Rick Snyder, the governor?
Yes.
Yeah, I like you. And lastly,
come on now, Matt.
Yeah, very
quickly.
You have
a bunch of people waiting.
I want to know about a blueprint in terms of where we need to go from here and also include what the EPA should be doing and how we can wake and shake them. And I'll listen over the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Well, first and foremost, the most important thing, my last name is spelled Guyette, Guyette. And if people really want a good understanding both of the origins of this crisis and the way that Flint residents came together to help expose it, we made a documentary called Here's to Flint. And so if people put in their search engine, Here's to Flint, in quote marks, and then ACLU, you'll get a link to our documentary. It's about 45 minutes long, but it really has a lot of information that explains what's going on. One of the points that you made is, yes, that the governor is not firing or demanding the resignation of a lot of people, including the director of Health and Human Services, Nick Lyon, who is the one who allegedly said everybody has to die of something. There is another person who alleges that Mr. Lyon, at another point, when was being urged to fund a research into the issue, allegedly said, quote, we can't afford to save everybody. So that's a extremely, if true, very, very callous disregard for the people that he's supposed to be there looking out for. So it's... And I am not familiar with a lot of instances where a public official is accused of involuntary manslaughter as a result of actions or inactions on their part on the job that are allowed to stay in their job, even if it were a suspension with pay. Because imagine what it's like if you are a Flint resident and your child has lower IQ and brittle bones and behavioral problems as a result of the lead poisoning, or your mom or dad or sibling died of Legionnaire's disease that might have been prevented if it would have been exposed right away. To hear the governor say that one of the people accused of creating that situation and allowing it to happen is instrumental in helping Flint recover from the damage done. I mean, it's almost sick in its perversity. you know, to be told that basically someone that did you accused of doing you great harm is also the person that's, you know, one of the people in charge of helping you recover. You know, how can you blame the people of Flint for not trusting this government? You know, it is really, I think, perverse, to be honest.
Jay from Ithaca, you're on the air with Kurt Guyot.
Hello.
Hello.
I understand that an automobile manufacturer in or around Flint that was using that water noticed that the water was impacting their production and was able to switch the water to their plant. And I didn't quite understand, in terms of the water distribution network and infrastructure, how they were able to do that to enable their production and not corrode their machines and so on.
Right.
And so would you explain how that took place and it was not done for the human population?
Sure. Happy to. You're absolutely right. In October of 2014, so keep in mind the switch occurred in April of 14. About 6 months later, a General Motors facility in Flint, an engine plant, the company said, this water is causing engine parts to rust before we even get them out of the door of the plant. And so they, General Motors got special dispensation from one of these state-appointed emergency managers to leave the Flint water system and get back on the Detroit system. At the same time, the city of Flint itself was prohibited from getting back on the Detroit system. So what you have is a situation where capital was protected and people were poisoned. It was more important to the governor and his appointees that nothing be done to cause problems for General Motors, and they basically bent over backwards in order to make it possible for them to get back on the Detroit system, and at the same time, they made it impossible for the people of Flint who were begging to be put back on the Detroit system. They were completely prevented from being able to do that.
And the water mains that provided water to the plant was able to be separated or diverted from
they got a different I can't tell you exactly the mechanics of it, but yes, they were able to reconnect to the Detroit system and get the clean, safe Detroit water, and meanwhile the people of Flint continued to get their water from the Flint River treated at the Flint Water Treatment Plant.
Thank you.
The network was
a good thing might have been for everybody to just show up at the plant to have their showers and cook their meals.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they should have done. Thank you so much, Jay, for your question. And that brings us to the end of the program today. Kurt, I can't thank you enough for participating voluntarily and freely in educating us about what's going on in Flint and why we need to pay attention to it and to monitor it, but also to support efforts that are fighting it, because people literally are dying and others are mortgaging their lives because the contamination and the crime against them is going to be lasting for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate what you're doing, and I thank you so much for your generosity.
Well, thank you for your ongoing interest in keeping people informed about this, because it is important. And so that's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Okay.
We'll keep in touch. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, and Stories, plural, at gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Tomorrow, you've got to tune in. It's a really interesting program tomorrow. Very, very, very pertinent to where we are politically. Bye-bye.